Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, as promised, folks, we are back with a midweek podcast, but frankly, even if we hadn't promised a midweek podcast, we would be back because, as you very well might have noticed, news has broken in the tennis world in the last couple of days. News in the form of a Vogue article. It's not often we get to break news via Vogue, but here we are, or rather here is Serena Williams writing a piece for the cover story of the September issue of Vogue, entitled Serena's Farewell to Tennis in Her Own Words. I am going to read some extracts from it to set the scene, but I do strongly encourage you to go and read the piece. It's free to read online, and it's incredibly powerful and somehow incredibly insightful about a woman that we've all known for 25 years to some degree, and yet I feel like I learned so much about her from this Vogue article, and I'm sure you'll feel the same if you get the chance to read it. On the subject of stepping away from the sport in which she's won 23 major titles, she says the following: I have never liked the word retirement. It doesn't feel like a modern word to me. I've been thinking of this as a transition, but I want to be sensitive about how I use that word, which means something very specific and important to a community of people. Maybe the best word to describe what I'm up to is evolution. I'm here to tell you that I'm evolving away from tennis toward other things that are important to me. A few years ago, I quietly started Serena Ventures, a venture capital firm. Soon after that, I started a family. I want to grow that family. But I've been reluctant to admit to myself or to anyone else that I have to move on from playing tennis. Alexis, my husband, and I have hardly talked about it. It's like a taboo topic. I can't even have this conversation with my mum and dad. It's like it's not real until you say it out loud. It comes up, I get an uncomfortable lump in my throat, and I start to cry. The only person I've really gone there with is my therapist. One thing I'm not going to do is sugarcoat this. I know that a lot of people are excited about and look forward to retiring, and I really wish I felt that way. Ashley Barty was number one in the world when she left the sport this March, and I believe she really felt ready to move on. Caroline Wozniacki, who's one of my best friends, felt a sense of relief when she retired in 2020. Praise to these people, but I'm going to be honest. There is no happiness in this topic for me. I know it's not the usual thing to say, but I feel a great deal of pain. It's the hardest thing that I could ever imagine. I hate it. I hate that I have to be at this crossroads. I keep saying to myself, I wish it could be easy for me, but it's not. I'm torn. I don't want it to be over, but at the same time, I'm ready for what's next. There's lots more that she talks about in the article, and we'll touch upon all of that as well, but I just want to pause there to get some initial reaction, because I found all of that so incredibly powerful, and it evoked a lot of emotion in me reading that. I feel relief at how hard she's finding it to leave the sport. I'm not pleased that she's in this pain and torment. Obviously, I'm not a total sadist, I like to think. But I'm also relieved that it's a wrench for her to leave this sport, that she still loves it that much, that it's this difficult and painful for her to leave. I feel some relief in that, because there's quite a lot of lazy analysis about Serena Williams, or there has been over the years, of sort of, oh, she's got all these other interests, you know, I think her commitment to and love for tennis will wane. I mean, people have been predicting that for 10 to 15 years, haven't they? And yeah, okay, maybe she's put her eyes on other things over the past few years, but that has not diminished clearly the fire that burns inside her for the sport.
Yeah, and I think my reaction to it was one of surprise. Not that she wrote this piece, not that it was in Vogue. I mean, I remember Maria Sharapova announced her retirement in Vogue as well. And I'm not surprised that she's announced that the end is nigh for her tennis playing career, or that it will come at the US Open. But I was surprised at the honesty, the candor in which she described how she was feeling about this process. And I was pleased that she did too. I was really overwhelmed by hearing how hard this is for her, how sad she is, that must take some doing to share that with us all, because I'm not surprised that she feels that way, knowing how tenacious she is as a competitor, how much of a perfectionist she is, how much she's been proving to us that she's the greatest player ever, in my opinion, for all these years, and how much she's been trying to get that final number on the board so that nobody can argue with it anymore. But to lay it all out there for everybody in her kind of retirement speech, effectively, is something that I don't think I've seen before from anybody who's announced their retirement. And look, it's a very individual thing, announcing your retirement when you're a great champion. And I suppose I'm old enough now to have seen a lot of players come into the scene as young players and then leave the sport, whatever it might be, 10, 15, 20 years later. And I always feel quite emotional about it in different ways, depending on who it is. Pete Sampras was my hero. He retired at 31 at the US Open. Andre Agassi sort of eked out more from his career than I think we ever expected to, a bit like Serena in a way. Got to 36 and then announced, and his body just couldn't handle it anymore. Andy Roddick sort of walked away when he could have carried on. He'd got more in him, but he didn't want to do it unless he was at the top anymore. And I think the contrast with her being a female champion is that she's experiencing something here that none of those men could experience, could know what it's like to have to wrestle with, to have to face down as somebody who's thinking, well, I can't look at it the way you can if I want to have what I want in life aside from in tennis, and that's to grow my family, having already won one Grand Slam whilst 2 months pregnant. You know, it's really opened my eyes again. I feel like the sport of tennis, and knowing you in particular, Catherine, and hopefully growing up a bit along the way, has taught me a lot about what women experience as opposed to what I might, or to what other male athletes that I might judge on an equal playing field have. And she's opened my eyes on another one here. And I think it's really powerful, to use that word again, that she wrote about it in this particular piece.
Have there ever been two more contrasting retirements in the same year than Ash Barty and Serena Williams, Matt? I mean, it's interesting that she references that and how unique an experience retirement is, but my goodness me, it's crazy how different those two retirement contexts are, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I've been thinking about Ash Barty's retirement this week again, I guess, in the context of Serena's. And in a way, Ash Barty in this very moment was kind of a bigger loss to the tennis world, you know, in terms of week in, week out. She was the current world number one, whereas Serena's hardly played for a year. And, you know, of course we miss Ash Barty. We really, really do. And yet we've spoken a lot about how incredible it is that someone has stepped into that void already. You know, Iga Świątek has done that this year. I still think the tour would be richer if Ash Barty was still there. But we now have a dominant world number one again. And we've kind of moved on, I suppose, even in just the last few months from Barty, while still missing her. Serena is an entirely different thing. You know, there is no one who can replace Serena Williams at all, ever. I mean, there never will be. It is a hole that she leaves in the sport that is so enormous. And I think that was kind of my big reaction, really, because, you know, we knew this. We knew this was coming. Of course we did. This is the podcast we knew we were going to have to record at some point, but it's a podcast none of us really wanted to have to record. And yet that only took away the surprise. It didn't take away the sort of shock of it. You know, I'm 26. I have never known tennis without Serena Williams. And that will be true of anyone my age, anyone about 5 years older than me, anyone who's become a fan of this sport in the last 20 years will not have known it without Serena Williams. And there's always been this possibility, even when she was away from the sport, that she would come back. We always had her to think about as a tennis player, involve her in the conversation. And this announcement took that possibility away and made it a bit more finite. And that was just something to come to terms with, you know. She's been such a presence in everyone's lives. It's really something. And yet what it does do is give us a three-week stretch here to celebrate Serena Williams. And I felt that watching her last night. I stayed up to watch her match in Toronto, and it was a celebration. And Serena Williams has always been an event. She's been a show that you want to watch and do not miss. And it feels like now more than ever that she is an event. It's a three-week celebration of Serena Williams, and no one wants to miss it.
It does feel like a gift that she's given us, doesn't it? Mm. Telling us that this is the end. And I know some people have interpreted that the wording in that Vogue piece as leaving the door open. I personally did not read it that way at all. I think she's uncomfortable with the finality of the word retirement. But it definitely does seem like this is the end to me, and the intended end point, while she doesn't specify this year's US Open, that is the very strong impression I get. And it feels like a gift that she's given us this sort of 3 week, maybe 4 week long Serena party. But I think it's for all those reasons that you've said, Matt, that actually I didn't assume that we would be recording this podcast, because I didn't think she would ever tell us that it was the end. And therefore, I didn't think we'd ever have to really brutally reckon with it being the end. It would just sort of suddenly be 10 years from now when we'd notice that Serena Williams hadn't played a tournament in 9 years, and we'd sort of go, oh, I suppose she's probably not coming back now. But the fact that she's announced us and told us has forced us, and certainly forced me, somebody who, as my therapist would say, is not great at dealing with endings, it's forced us to deal with it. And obviously, and that's mirrored in what Serena's said about her own experience, you know, being forced to confront it and not be in denial anymore. I think I've been in denial, you know, because while it's not final, there's always the chance that she could go, oh, I've taken a wild card into insert obscure tournament's name here. I didn't want to throw a tournament under the bus. I've done too much slagging off Kitzbühel recently. Miscellaneous small tournament here. You know, there's always the possibility, and while there's possibility, you don't have to confront it, do you? But she's made herself and all of us confront what a Serena-less tennis world looks like. And it's exactly the same as you, Matt. I'm not as young as you, but she's been there my whole tennis watching life.
Lints can I offer?
I was going to say Linz, and I thought it's harsh on Linz.
It's wasn't Austria.
Wasn't Linz Coco again. Gough's first title?
It was, yeah. I'm watching at the moment, actually. just on that, I think that she probably has had a real time getting to this point, because I can believe that might have been part of the plan, was to just walk away and quietly do so. She'd kind of intimated that, hasn't she, in the past? And I think she wrestles with these two contrasting versions of herself. The one who watching that match last night did look uncomfortable at times in the aftermath of the defeat and all the palaver that was going on, and the tournament doing their very best to show their love for her. It is exhausting, and it is a bit awkward sometimes when these tournaments are lavishing words of praise on you, and I think that and she was struggling to kind of keep her composure and hold it together in a way that I think she's desperate to on one level. And yet there's another side to her which is really theatrical and an amazing person of the moment who will stop people in their tracks to watch and listen and feel things. And so, look, she's all of that, and it's wonderful, I think. I also think that just in terms of her career generally, I've been keen to not forget some of the poor behaviour that I've seen from her on court and directed at officialdom. But I feel able more to reconcile it now, reading that piece, thinking about who she is as a perfectionist, as a somebody who just desperately wanted to win and couldn't handle it, you know. And a lot of players can't handle it in the moment, and it leads to abominable behaviour at times. But I'm glad she's doing this. I'm glad that there is a few weeks for her, for everybody who's interested in tennis, for the good of the sport generally, because going on the front cover of Vogue brings people in. Having this farewell selection of tournaments brings people into the sport, which is what she's been all about all along. And, I think we're going to have a lot of emotion to deal with over the next few weeks.
Yes, I feel like I've been thinking about what that moment will be at the US Open, with obviously Joe Wilfred Tsonga, This Is Your Life at Roland Garros as as the bar here. You know, they've got to clear that, and that's quite a high bar.
There was an army of about 40 people wearing Joe Wilfred Tsonga custom-made T-shirts.
Yeah, it's got to be
a high bar.
It's got to be 23 times that, I would say.
I want everyone inside the Arthur Ashe Stadium wearing a Serena Williams T-shirt. Yeah, it's got to be a goat bar, hasn't it? She says in this piece, she talks about, there are people who say I'm not the goat because I didn't pass Margaret Court's record of 24 Grand Slam titles, which she achieved before the Open era that began in 1968. I'd be lying if I said I didn't want that record. Obviously I do. But day to day, I'm really not thinking about her. If I'm in a Grand Slam final, then yes, I'm thinking about that record. Maybe I thought about it too much and that didn't help. The way I see it, I should have had 30 plus Grand Slams. I had my chances after coming back from giving birth. I went from a C-section to a second pulmonary embolism to a Grand Slam final. I played while breastfeeding. I played through postpartum depression, but I didn't get there. Shoulda, woulda, coulda. I didn't show up the way I should have or could have, but I showed up 23 times and that's fine. Actually, it's extraordinary. But these days, if I have to choose between building my tennis resume and building my family, I choose the latter. And I hope and I think that with some time, we will reflect on those four Grand Slam finals she reached after giving birth to Olympia quite differently to how we reflected on them at the time. At the time, and even now, just as Serena has just described, they felt like missed opportunities to get to 24 because it was all about 24. I think with some reflection, we'll look at it as she reached four Grand Slam finals after not only a pregnancy, but an incredibly traumatic cesarean birth during which she nearly died. I mean, her abdominal muscles were ripped apart And she came back and reached four Grand Slam titles and finals. And as she revealed there, you know, was breastfeeding and experiencing postpartum depression as well. And that is unreal. She talked about her legacy. She said, "I don't particularly like to think about my legacy. I get asked about it a lot and I never know exactly what to say, but I'd like to think that thanks to opportunities afforded to me, women athletes feel that they can be themselves on court. They can play with aggression and pump their fists. They can be strong yet beautiful. They can wear what they want and say what they want and kick butt and be proud of it all. I've made a lot of mistakes in my career. Mistakes are learning experiences. And I embrace those moments. I'm far from perfect, but I've also taken a lot of criticism. And I'd like to think that I went through some hard times as a professional tennis player so that the next generation could have it easier. Over the years, I hope that people come to think of me as symbolising something bigger than tennis. I admire Billie Jean. I think she means king, not the dog, but she doesn't specify, so we might never know. She says, I admire Billie Jean because she transcended her sport. I'd like it to be Serena is this and she's that and she was a great tennis player and she won those slams. And that got me emotional too because I really think that Serena has changed, forced us to change, and by us I mean the world, to change the way we perceive female athletes and how we value them. There's still a ways to go. There is still far too much emphasis on the aesthetic and on traditional ideas of femininity designed as designated by the patriarchy. But by through her struggle of confronting just a grotesque slew of body shaming, sexist, racist body shaming throughout her career, but in particular at the start, she has changed the world a little bit through that struggle. She's made that struggle a bit less for those coming up behind her, and I just think that can't be underestimated. And there's still, you know, I looked at some of the comments on the Vogue post, which I know you should just never look at comments. I do know that. But anyway, I looked and there's so much hate about the fact that the cover photo is airbrushed. Folks, every single photo you have ever looked at in any magazine or print publication, or certainly magazine publication, since the invention of airbrushing, was airbrushed. Don't hate the player, hate the game. And I do hate that game, by the way. Publications should have to declare airbrushing. It is setting unrealistic beauty standards for women and men, but largely women. Anyway, but that's a separate podcast. Basically, definitely don't hate on Serena for that.
Yeah, and I think that paragraph you just read out really spoke to me as well, because in a way I've always found Serena one of the hardest players to talk about. You know, I want to get it right about Serena, and yet I'm not American, I'm not a woman, and I'm not black. And those three things are so fundamental to who Serena is and what she means, and understanding her place in tennis, in sport, in society. And I think one of the most extraordinary things about Serena is that she achieved all that she has in a sport which is traditionally very white, which didn't embrace her at several points throughout her career. And simply by her being black, by her being confident, by her looking physically different to other players, by being successful, you know, just all of those things offended people. She was seen as a sort of threat, and issues about race and gender were always raised, and drama was never far around the corner. And I just always felt how exhausting it must be for her to, you know, that weight, just simply being herself would constantly throw up all these aggressions towards her, you know, and there's some high profile stuff, like the president of the Russian Tennis Federation referring to her and Venus as the brothers. There's obviously the booing and the racial abuse that was heard at Indian Wells and led to her boycotting that tournament for so many years. There was her father being accused of fixing matches, you know, all of these things. And in the face of all that, Serena still pumped her fist. She still showed her rage on court. She still jumped for joy. And therefore, she changed the way people talk about female athletes, black female athletes. And that is so, so powerful. And that is probably the thing I admire most about her, really. And in any conversation about the GOAT debate, there's the internal impact on the sport, titles, records. Serena's side holds up really well, of course. We know all about that. But there's also that external impact, and Serena had that as well. And she also raised the global profile of the game and took it beyond tennis. And I think she will be looked back on for both of those two things, what she did in the sport and also the way, as you said, black female athletes are perceived. She's so important.
Last extract from the Vogue piece that I want to end this segment on, because I think it'll just get us all extra pumped for the Serena party that's coming our way over the next few weeks. She says, "Unfortunately, I wasn't ready to win Wimbledon this year, and I don't know if I'll be ready to win New York, but I'm going to try. And the lead-up tournaments will be fun. I know there's a fan fantasy that I might have tied Margaret that day in London, then maybe beat her record in New York, and then at the trophy ceremony say, 'See ya.' I get that. It's a good fantasy. But I'm not looking for some ceremonial final on-court moment. I'm terrible at goodbyes. The world's worst. But please know that I'm more grateful for you than I can ever express in words. You have carried me to so many wins and so many trophies. I'm going to miss that version of me, that girl who played tennis, and I'm going to miss you." All I'm going to say on the fantasy thing, folks, is that, and PS, don't at me, this is not a prediction, but Serena winning the US Open this year is significantly less improbable than Emma Raducanu winning it last year. And with that, the hype train gets a rolling.
I agree.
David's been putting things in our WhatsApp group like, "I think Serena's going to go on a run."
Yeah, extremely vague references to a run or a big moment. Is she going to take our breath away one last time, yeah. David?
Yeah, I mean, I do think back to Andre Agassi in 2006, who had that incredible match against Marcus Baghdatis. And I hope for something similar for Serena at the very least, that she has an amazing match, that she can roll back the years and play the greatest hits in a match that makes us all remember what she was able to do, what she brought to the sport. I don't think we're going to see the same tennis, because I think it's very easy to forget just how great a tennis player she was. Forget everything else for a second. This woman was an incredible tennis player who just destroyed everybody. But I hope that there are moments, and I think it is possible if she could win a couple. You know, if she needs a decent draw, I think. I mean, watching her against Belinda Bencic last night made me think, what an awful draw this is for her, because Bencic is so clever. It puts you off balance, diverts your power back onto you. But there are certain players, and look, there are a lot of tough draws in women's tennis right now, but there are some where she could just tee off and overwhelm. And if she could have a couple of those and get into the tournament, I think something, certainly an epic match where she maybe knocks out somebody big, like a top five seed, is absolutely possible, and an appearance in the second week.
Oh, he's sort of put a round on it, ish. Second week is still quite vague though, David. I'm not going to press you now. But I'm just going to say that I know we've had some exciting draw days of late, Grand Slam draw days, because there have been exciting unseeded lurkers in draws, but can you imagine the feverish anticipation of the women's draw at the US Open this year on Thursday, the 25th of August, the very same day that we arrive in New York City? I am already feverish myself. And PS, the US Open announced, didn't they, that they had had the most extraordinary surge in ticket sales off the back of Serena's announcement. I mean, they don't even know when she'll be playing her first match, and it's like everybody's just bought every ticket available just on the off chance that Serena might be playing in that session. It's amazing.
Good move.
And it's going to be so exciting, and we can't wait. And maybe she will take our breath away one more time. She wasn't able to last night, as you said, Matt. She lost out after winning her opening round match to Parisa's Diaz, 6-3, 6-4. She lost to Belinda Bencic last night in Toronto, 6-2, 6-4. Bencic now plays Garbiñe Muguruza in the round of 16, who, folks, has won two tennis match. No, sorry, she got a bye in the first round. Has won one tennis match.
Two sets.
Still noteworthy.
Does feel noteworthy, doesn't it?
It shouldn't, yeah. But I mean,
she beat the Washington finalist, Kai Kanepi, 4-4. That's Kanepi had just, well, I mean, she beat an injured Naomi Osaka in the opening round. Unfortunately, Osaka retired injured, training a set and three love to Kanepi. But a win is big for Muguruza.
Yeah, especially if talking about laying it all out, how you're feeling. That press conference she gave not so long ago where she just said, I just don't know what to do. I'm doing all the things you're supposed to do. And here she is, one of those players that Andy Roddick talks about, with experience but no form and no confidence. And she cannot figure out the solutions. And you just need, it's like the football player who's on a barren spell in front of goal and just needs one to go in off the knee. And Garbiñe Muguruza got herself a win against Kaya Kanepi. And I didn't watch the match. For all I know, Kaya Kanepi hit 158 unforced errors. But the fact is, she won a match. And maybe that will be a big difference maker for her.
Just on that Kanepi win over an injured Osaka, I watched that match on replay. Matt, you watched it as well. It was a really sad sight, wasn't it, seeing Osaka just unable to compete physically. It's not good, is it, at this distance out from the US Open? That didn't look good to me. Have you got any reasons to be cheerful?
I was quite cheerful about Osaka on Monday, wasn't I? In fact, I think I said she looks fit, and that didn't age well. It was sad. It was her back that she was getting treatment for. And I think worth saying as well, it must have been quite a tough day for Osaka. You know, we know how much Osaka looks up to Serena Williams. She played on the day when Serena Williams's Vogue piece came out. I think she tweeted after the match something like, this has just been a really, really bad day. Tough for Osaka, because she was playing well, I thought. You know, shocking news, tennis player hits the ball well, but she was. And but she just couldn't move, especially at the start of that second set, and had to pull out. And yeah, just a couple of weeks out from the US Open, it's not good. And, you know, kind of like she had that injury earlier on in the year, it kind of lingered and just sort of took out that whole clay court season that she'd been so enthusiastic about trying to figure out. One little injury sort of took it all out, and I would hate for that to be the case here, which is usually her best time of year.
Other round of 16 matches that we have got in Toronto include Simona Halep against Jill Teichmann. Teichmann took out Venus Williams 2-3. In the opening round, we have Coco Gauff against Aryna Sabalenka. That match is currently in progress. Looks like Coco Gauff is going to win. 7-5, 3-2. Really hope that doesn't go out of date.
She was 3 love up.
Oh, that's a shame. Can we talk about Gauff-Rybakina, please? One of the matches of the year, I think. 7-6 in the third to Coco Gauff yesterday.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I was properly double screening over dinner with the kids, and that was one of the two matches I was watching, with the other one being Carlos Alcaraz against Tommy Paul. But the eye just kept getting drawn to Goff and Rybakina. I think it's amplified now because Rybakina is Wimbledon champion. It's also amplified by the fact that she's wearing that Adidas outfit. That, oh my word, that is mm-hmm. awful. Catherine, you drew my attention to that. It is a howler of an outfit, I think. Now, it looks like somebody's attacked the players with a bunch of paintbrushes. Anyway, but it was a brilliant tennis match, and Goff was leading by a set. She had four match points in the second set tiebreak, and Rybakina got it back into a third set. It went all the way, and both players just came out of it. I don't know how Rybakina feels, but it felt like a win for her as well, in a way, because she nearly rescued it. And she doesn't always feel like she plays that well in some of these tournaments. And now she's starting to look the part. She looks like a champion. And yet Goff looks like she's gone to another level as well. She's so tenacious, and she's such a good athlete. And the forehand seemed a lot more reliable to me than it has of late. She's blooming. And I keep on picking Coco Gauff to reach finals and win things, and I think I'm just going to carry on because it's going to happen.
Oh, like me and Bedossa.
I don't think there are many mentally stronger players than Gauff at the moment. You know, that recovery after dropping that second set, and you know, maybe you could say it wasn't mentally tough that she did kind of blow it on three of those four match points. I think she made errors. She probably should have taken it there. But given that she didn't, to then recover in that second set, in that third set, play so well, I thought just showed how tough she is and how difficult she is to beat at the moment. I still think game-wise, you know, I know the forehand is holding up. There have been quite a lot of double faults today. There are still these little holes that she can improve, I think. But just from a competing level, she is right there at the top, I think, at the moment.
Yulia Putintseva faces Alison Risk Armitage. Putintseva beat Bedossa. That was a retirement from Bedossa yesterday. That's a tough one for Bedossa. Felt like she was coming into some form. So Putintseva against Risk Armitage, who beat Yelena Ostapenko in an extremely Yelena Ostapenko-y scoreline. It was 7-6, love 6, 7-5. So, plus ça change. Jessica Pegula will face the defending champion Camilla Giorgi, round of 16. Bianca Andreescu up against Zheng Qin Wen. I'm here for it. I'm here for what Andreescu's doing this week. 6-3 in the third over drama queen for the people, Elise Cornet, last night. And in the opening round, 7-6, 6-4 over the San Jose champion, Daria Kazatkina, where she was a bit of a drama queen for the people herself.
Yeah, another great match. I know that was straight sets, but Kazatkina coming off a title last week and gave a frosty handshake to Andreescu at the end, and Andreescu visited by the trainer a couple of times and a couple of awkward moments, really, timings-wise. One, I think, 2-1 in the tiebreak, but she was not feeling well. And it's really difficult, isn't it? What's supposed to happen? If you're not feeling well, if you're feeling terrible, what are you supposed to do? Just carry on. I don't know. I don't know what you're supposed to do. I understand Kazatkina maybe getting frustrated, being held up and all the rest of it. But I also think if I'm not feeling well, I'm probably just going to have to find out if I can make it better somehow or if I can have a rest for a bit. And but just putting that aside, her tennis looks really, really good. And she's another one. We're talking about Serena getting a couple of wins. If Andreescu could just get a few wins, just a few matches, you know, the form could come because the pedigree, the ability is there. We know it's there from 3 years ago.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with her tennis this week. I can see her growing in confidence. The conviction on her shots, her backhand has been such a weapon She seems to be finding the right balance with variety, not overusing it, but, you know, picking the right times to slice both the forehand and the backhand. She seems to be trusting her instincts again, and it's not baked in yet. You know, it's still at the fragile stages of confidence, but I can see it coming. If she can just keep the roll going, I think it could be quite powerful. But look, we know how talented Jung is, and I'll be staying up for that match later on today. We've got Karolina Pliskova against Maria Sakkari, Bencic Muguruza we discussed, and Iga Świątek in the round of 16, David. P.S. She demolished Ila Tomljanovic 6-1-6-2 in her opener. Świątek faces Beatrice Haddad-Maia.
Oh, welcome back.
Which you wouldn't care about because you've dropped her like a hot potato.
Well, you know, maybe I can have some sort of residual credit at this point.
Well, she beat Leila Fernandez. I'd say that's quite a good win. 7-6-6-1 over Fernandez.
It is. And actually, I am quite looking forward to watching her just to see what she's like, because I sort of picked her to win Wimbledon on the basis of results that I didn't actually watch. So, you know, these are more good results, and I'm looking forward to discovering what sort of player let me down at Wimbledon.
Well, you can watch her face Świątek, and you can find out who, seeing as we're at the halfway stage, I'm going to go in here for some predictions. Who's going to win? Toronto.
Well, my pick is still in, so I'm going to stick with it.
Who's
Simona
your pick?
Simona Halep. To be honest, the only reason I picked her is because she was in the other half of the draw to where all the big names were. And I just sometimes like a player sneaking through that. And she's won in Canada before. She's looked good in her first two matches. She's beaten Donna Vekic and Zhang Shuai without too much fuss. But if I, you know, I also did that for points, predictions points. If I was being logical, Iga Świątek starting the tournament like that, that sends a message to me. I feel like she's here to remind everyone that she's the world number one.
David, anyone beating Świątek this week?
Well, I was going to say Coco Gauff, but unlike Matt, I haven't really figured out which half of the draw she's in. So, but the fact that she beat Rybakina and is now 7-5-4-2 up in soon-to-be-up-to-date tennis news against Aryna Sabalenka, I think she's playing exceptional stuff, and I'm going to go with her anyway, regardless.
Okay. I agree with both of you, one of Świątek or Gauff. Maybe Andreescu. There you go. There's a punchy prediction for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Over to Montreal we go, where interesting things have been happening in Montreal. Matt, you said on WhatsApp earlier that you're really intrigued by the Montreal draw at this halfway stage. Pray tell, explain.
Well, I think on paper it's probably lacking something, you know, and that would be because, well, yesterday, wasn't it, the top three seeds, Medvedev, Alcaraz and Tsitsipas, I'm sure we'll talk about all of their matches, but they all lost, which means that This is the first time at an ATP Masters 1000 event that the top three seeds have all lost their opening match since Indian Wells in 1999. We're kind of, you know, in unprecedented territory here, certainly in recent memory. And also Andrei Rublev lost. So a lot of the big names are gone. And yet, I just think the names that are left, you've got a lot of intriguing players there who haven't won at this level. And I'm talking about Sinner. I'm talking about Kyrgios. I'm talking about Tommy Paul. I'm talking Felix Auger-Aliassime, Alex de Minaur. It just feels like a big moment for all of those. And then there's Cameron Norrie. Can he win another one? There's Taylor Fritz. Can he win another one? Hurkacz. You know, there's a real opportunity, I think, for a lot of players. And going into the US Open, which I probably see, given that we don't think Djokovic is going to be playing, and there are, you know, there has to be question marks about Rafael Nadal's fitness, just because we've seen him get injured a lot this year. His body is breaking down. It feels like a very open US Open to me. And whoever wins this tournament from here, I just think will nudge themselves up in that conversation in terms of going into that tournament. So I think it's intriguing, even though it is probably lacking that real star power.
There are three results from the last round of matches that stand out, and that's Tommy Paul beating Carlos Alcaraz 6-3 in the third, Jack Draper beating Stefanos Tsitsipas 7-5, 7-6, and Nick Kyrgios beating Daniil Medvedev 6-7, 6-4, 6-2. I think between us, we've watched all of that smorgasbord of tennis. Should we start with Alcaraz losing, or rather Tommy Paul winning? This match was fantastically entertaining.
Yeah, it was. And it was 7-6-4-1 to Alcaraz, and he lost from there. Or, if you prefer, Tommy Paul launched an incredible fight back. And I do think Paul was superb, and I think he's maybe watched the matches that Jannik Sinner played against Alcaraz. I don't have any evidence of that.
I thought that.
But just the way he was going about it, he felt way more aggressive to me than I've seen him in the past. And it felt like he was trying to half volley stuff, take things early to take time away from Alcaraz, to stop Alcaraz having the chance to set and really tee off and dominate. And it seems that there's a bit of a blueprint there that you can divert Alcaraz's power. You can move him around in a way that he's having to come up with just casino shots in order to win some rallies from where he is in the court. And I don't know whether that's just maybe a confidence thing, because obviously Alcaraz won Miami and he beat really, really good players in order to do so. But there's a difference in recent weeks, and Sinner did it by being able to take the ball incredibly early and hit darting shots at him before, and they were on him before he could even react properly, and I think Tommy Paul did the same.
Carlos Alcaraz did a social media post after the match, Matt, saying it was the first time that I couldn't handle the pressure. I have to be ready to have this pressure, to have these kind of moments, and to learn how to handle it. Fist clench emoji.
Yeah, very, very honest, I suppose. David pointed out that maybe Hugo Gaston has got his hand up, saying, "I'm not sure you handled the pressure against me in Bercy last year all that well." But I think it does speak to where Alcaraz is at the moment. And I've actually felt like Tommy Paul gave a really interesting quote afterwards, where he said that he is extra motivated when he plays a guy like Alcaraz, because Alcaraz he's not at the level of Nadal and Djokovic yet, where people are stepping on the court against him with no belief. You know, I think a lot of the time the big three have won matches kind of before they've even started because of their aura and their presence. At the moment, Alcaraz is a target, and he's made himself a target by being so good, so young. You know, there was that comment from Medvedev, wasn't there? The famous Carlos Alcaraz. It was a great line, but it was also it told you what the other players feel about it. You know, that they want a piece of that. They want to beat the guy who everyone is saying is the next big thing. And I think Sinner's probably felt some of that. Musetti felt some of that. Similar age group. Paul isn't that much older. He probably thinks that as well. And Paul was amazing. He was absolutely brilliant. He's had some big wins on hard court before. This is the biggest. And yeah, he's got Chris Evert's seal of approval. I noticed she tweeted, "When did Tommy Paul get so good?" Which I really love the thought of her watching that and, you know, being amazed by it.
She's right, though. He's so improved. Such a better tennis player than he was even 6 months ago. I think he's really starting to look the business now, and I loved that match against Alcaraz. So impressive. And he is coming out with some great lines. Tommy Paul of tennis players are weird, quote, fame. That's an all-timer. What else did I mention? Jack Draper beating Stefanos Tsitsipas last night to make it through to the round of 16. He'll face Gael Monfils later on today. He's starting to turn up and be a name. I was going to say in the mix. I don't mean the mix. I don't mean our mix. I don't mean winning the US Open mix. But, you know, he's a proper tour pro. Sounds really sort of damning by faint praise, doesn't it? But I don't know, he's just proper, isn't he? I love watching him play tennis. And what I loved about the win over Tsitsipas was, Tsitsipas did not play his best. It was inconsistent, massively inconsistent. He's doing that thing on serve where he's, you know, the Mary Carrillo quote, if your serve requires good footwork, something's going wrong. And something is definitely going wrong for Tsitsipas. You know, there's stuff to sort out there. And you look at his box and you can sort of see Philippoussis itching to do stuff. And then you've got Apostolos looming there. And I do just wonder how that dynamic works, because it seems pretty clear to me that Apostolos is running that ship, and while Mark Philippoussis might be having some impact, I doubt he's able to, you know, properly wrestle the situation and be able to have the full impact that he wants to. But anyway, hugely inconsistent performance from Stefanos Tsitsipas, but he was banking on Jack Draper going away. You know, there were a few occasions where Tsitsipas hustled himself back into the match, you know, using his experience and big hitting and presence on the court. And so many young players with Jack Draper's level of experience in these sorts of matches would have just gone away, said, okay, well, I had my opportunity. I was a set and a break up. I've lost it. I'm now a breakdown. He just didn't go away. He's got this real self-belief and level head, but also combined with swagger. And it's a really heady combination.
Yes, that's exactly it. When I first saw Jack Draper, and, you know, I think that was probably Wimbledon Juniors, what I remembered is that I felt like he was flashy. You know, I felt like he was the guy who would hit, you know, two great shots and then a load of bad ones, but you would remember the great ones, and you would remember the way he carried himself on the court. But actually, as he's evolved as a player on the tour, I've been really impressed by how solid he is and patient. You know, Tsitsipas was, as you said, peppering that backhand, waiting for it to break down. Draper was just rallying, putting it to a length, being really, really disciplined with it. And then he's also got power when he needs it. You know, he can turn on the flash if he needs it. But generally, he's molding himself into a really solid player with a great base that he can then use his talents to sort of build on. And yeah, I'm really impressed with him. I think his ranking's inside the top 70 now, I think, after this week, which is a huge leap from where he was at the start of the year. It's been real progress.
Yeah, he's on the cusp of, he's not far away from not having to qualify for Masters events, which is absolutely massive. A last match from Montreal I wanted to touch upon was Nick Kyrgios's defeat of Daniil Medvedev. You guys both watched this. I managed to miss it. Well done, mate. It's not like I host a tennis podcast or anything. Why would I need to watch what was apparently the match of the year?
No, it
Thanks,
wasn't.
Twitter, but, for letting but, me know what I missed.
It was good. It was a really good contest. It was a really interesting match. Just there was a lot to look out for. It was tactically fascinating to see how Kyrgios approached playing the metronome from down the other end, and who came out playing well? Medvedev. And the first set was a tiebreak set that Medvedev won, and it was really, really nip and tuck until the tiebreak, when you could see Kyrgios lost his focus and Medvedev just capitalised. It was an easy tiebreak win for him. And that was the moment where you saw a Kyrgios that I don't think we've seen very often in the past before. He didn't throw his toys. He didn't behave abominably. He knuckled down. He broke immediately. And actually, by sort of rallying at length, almost for the sake of it, in the early parts of the second set, to just see what Medvedev was going to do next. And Medvedev kind of broke down a bit. And once Kyrgios had got the break right at the start of that second set, he has such confidence in that serve. That serve is not going to let him down. So fine. Then he can experiment on the return. And it reminded me a lot of watching Pete Sampras in his heyday of, I'm going to roll through my service games and then I'm going to get creative on my return. Against Andre Agassi, those were the great matchups. And there were some similarities here. Obviously, Kyrgios is throwing in a hell of a lot of different looks than Sampras would. He's doing the whole thing. He did two underarm serves. He's doing off-pace shots. He's suddenly charging to the net. He's suddenly injecting incredible pace into shots, and then he's rallying. I think he stayed loose throughout. The surprising thing was the way Medvedev went away in the third set that Kyrgios won 6-2. But that was a big psychological achievement from Kyrgios, I think, in terms of his status, his new status in the upper echelons of the sport. It made you feel as though he actually wants it even maybe more than I thought, to be a significant figure at the top of the game.
Who's going to win? Montreal. This is great radio.
Well, Sinner.
They're both
Sinner, because I picked Sinner to win the tournament, so I'm going to stick with that.
But do you actually think he's going to win?
Yeah.
Matt, please produce some dynamic radio.
I don't think anyone's playing better tennis than Kyrgios. I was a bit worried about his back in that match. You know, he did all of those things despite appearing to have a little bit of physical problems. I struggle to see anyone beating Kyrgios, though. The way he's serving, as David said, for Medvedev not to be able to break, you know, he's a world-class returner, and Kyrgios was brilliant. So, you know, if I had to pick at this stage, fitness permitting, I think I would go Kyrgios.
Wowzers, he's got Dumanol next later on today, Ramos Vinolas, Hubert Hurkacz in his quarter, and then Ruud, Roberto Bautista Agut, Cameron Norrie, Felix Auger-Aliassime in his half. So that's Montreal with four days of competition remaining, both tournaments at the round of 16 stage. We'll be back, of course, on Monday to round up both tournaments, and we'll not even look ahead to Cincinnati, because Cincinnati will already be underway at that point, and I'll be having to gaze at that roller coaster, wishing I was on it, having the adrenaline rush that I so crave. Ah, Kings Island. Anyway, that's for Monday and for all of next week. What a whirlwind of a couple of days with Serena's announcement and everything that's been going on in Canada. It really feels like the US Open series is properly in full swing now, and I can taste the US Open. It's right on the tip of my tongue. I can taste it, and maybe you can too, because in association with Wilson, we are running a US Open tickets competition. For two tickets to the US Open day session on Louis Armstrong Stadium on Tuesday, the 6th of September. To enter, you need to be a friend of the podcast. To become a friend, there's a link in our show notes in this podcast. If you're already a friend and want the link to enter the competition, just send us an email at friends@tennispodcast.net. So, there's lots of reasons to become a friend of the pod. Our memory bank, that's not the right term, is it? Our bank full of past Friends Only episodes, all of the Friends Only episodes that are still to come, including two editions of US Open Relived and a special US Open review show and lots of Q&A shows as well. But this, thanks to Wilson, is one extra little reason to become a friend of the pod. We have a mascot this week. It is Frieda. Frieda is lovely. Kevin Lee adopted Frieda from the Humane Society in Minnesota, where she had been brought after living a year as a stray in Texas. Frieda is 1 year old, and her hobbies include snuggles, destroying magazines, and being perpetually disappointed that she can't get Kevin's two cats to play with her. My question for Kevin, if you'd like to get in touch, is Frieda named after Frieda Kahlo? Would like to know. Anyway, Frieda is absolutely beautiful. I do like pictures that people send where their dog has one ear up and one ear down. That is one of my favourite genres of dog photos. So thank you, Kevin, for bringing Frieda into our lives. We, of course, have our mascots. David's got Darwin.
They're
still in the game this week, as are Matt and the dearly departed Gerald. Unfortunately, Carter, Dinil Medvedev, the world number one, let us down this week. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Ilana Kloss. We have two executive producers. They are both top blokes, and they are Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner. And we have shout outs, Matt.
We do. We have Kate Darling in Astoria, Oregon, USA.
Oh, what a name. Like Alistair Darling, our former Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yeah. Mm. And Captain Darling from the Blackadder show.
Yes. Mm,
both cultural references that Kate probably doesn't understand, what with not being from the United Kingdom. So right, apologies Kate. There, Kate. There are tennis Kates, aren't they? Kate.
Makarova?
E. McNally?
Yeah. Katie Bolter.
Yeah. Hmm. Slightly dodgy territory here to Kate.
Nobody wants to just stick with Kate, do they, in tennis? They want to change it.
No. Anyway, Kate, you're a one-off, and we're very grateful for your support. Thank you.
We've also got Trisha Fitzgerald in Castle Pines, Colorado.
Whoa. What a place that sounds like. I want to go.
Places in England are never called like Castle Pines, are they?
No.
It's always Woking. Durham. Colchester. Hey. The places are fine, but they're not exotic, sensual names, are they?
Burnley.
There's Strawberry Hill.
That sounds like he's trying a bit too hard there.
Yeah. Anyway, Castle Pine sounds great. Trisha, thank you very much.
Yeah, Trisha, thanks.
And finally today, we've got Sylvia Guidara in Melbourne, Australia.
Oh.
Right, Sylvia.
Well, very Tennessee location. Are there any tennis Sylvias?
Sylvia Talaya, the Croatian player of a few years ago.
Off he goes.
So tell us more, that's David. All, or was that all
I
you
can
have?
Give you. That's
you've
it.
Done for, I can't believe we found a Sylvia, but not a Kate.
Wasn't there a Sylvia Haneker? Sylvia Haneker reached the French Open final, I think.
Blimey, Matt, that's a good one. As long as it's right.
This is a man that compiles a lot of stats, folks. And if you would like access to those stats, subscribe to our newsletter.
Oh, good.
I promised I wouldn't plug that anymore because obviously anybody that isn't already a subscriber is an idiot. But there we go. I've plugged it anyway. And I've slagged off half our listenership in the process. Sylvia, thanks ever so much for your support. We'll be back with another pod on Monday. We'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Getting caught in the wrong shoes can interrupt your plans for the day, like when that 10% chance of rain ends up looking more like 100%. When the transition to fall and winter feels more like experiencing every season on the same day, there's the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Cross off errands with the splash protection on the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with all-condition traction and reflective details on the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Mudguard on the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. allbirds.com, code FRESHSOCKS.